I'm Matthias Valina, speaking with Lynn Emanuel in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, November 22nd, 2002. I told a friend of mine recently that you're my favorite noir poet, explaining the noir influence that I saw in Then Suddenly, especially in the politics and narrative and the pieces that we have in Blackbird now. And I was wondering whether you could speak a little bit about how you see noir and why you see it affecting you.
Do you know that I didn't even realize how foregrounded a noir aesthetic was in my poetry until Jerry Stern picked The Dig, frankly, for the National Poetry Series. I had chosen a title that was Big Black Car or something like that, and he said, no, he said, you don't want people to read you only according to that aesthetic. So actually, the noir influence seeped up like groundwater. It was nothing that I consciously appropriated. I think the way I came to it was when I went to the University of Iowa and for the first time really had the time to write a lot and think of writing a book rather than sort of sneaking poems in around a real world life and schedule. I started to devour the library at Iowa, and for the first time, I read Raymond Chandler and I read some of the other famous noir writers. And I think I was so enraptured, especially with the lusciousness of the writing. And it seemed in poetry, if I went after lusciousness, I couldn't find any models that I found pleasing or that I didn't feel would be appropriate to me. But the kind of richness of those noir writers seemed possible to appropriate and use to do something with in my own writing. So I think I was looking for a certain poetic style. And oddly, I found that by reading all the old noir writers, I found a way into that style that seemed an easier or better way in than when I read certain poets. Of course, along with that, I had to imbibe their iconography. And then I think that some of that started putting pressure on my work. I think that issues, for instance, of class and gender, all of that started to seep in because of my interest in those writers. But I was actually quite naive. I'd not read Dashiell Hammett, I'd not read Chandler, I hadn't read any of the noir writers, so that it wasn't as though I started out wanting to imitate something I knew and admired. It was that I came upon them as a surprise, and they led their way into my work, pushing it around and pushing it in a certain direction, which is maybe how more influence happens than we might expect. Mm-hmm.
Do you think their lushness was more appealing because it was tempered with the kind of dirt and grime?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. And also, you know, this was 1980s. There was not a lot of distinctive stuff going on right at that moment, you know? Or at least I think for the generation of people that I was at Iowa with, I think we were all kind of looking for who we were going to be, and there were lots of different influences. Well, Larry Levis was at Iowa at that time, and a lot of people were very influenced by his work. Donald Justice, of course, was there, and a lot of people, surprising number of people, like Marilyn Chin, who worked very closely with Don, were very influenced by him. But it was a kind of grab bag of different aesthetics. So it didn't seem so odd that I would go to this, you know, this sort of novelistic tradition and catch a hold of it to do something in my own work. But yeah, absolutely. I think in a certain way it reproduced parts of my own life, that style, but did it symbolically or metaphorically. I mean, the kind of issues of class, issues of money, issues of power, gender, all of that.
I ask about the contrast or the lushness and the dirt, because the poem on Blackbird, you say, I think, the final line of noir food is, it's a hard and dirty world,
which right.
doesn't seem to be fitting of your aesthetic.
Right.
And I think what I see in the noir usage that you have, it you're able to turn a cliche into something new and delightful with the noir language, and you're able to have the dirty streets and such and the long dark roads, but the beautiful language as well. That very much fits a lot of what you're trying to do with your poetry and the contrasts.
I think that's absolutely true. I think there are other things about the noir sensibility that really appealed to me. It's intensely obsessive. It recycles the same images, film to film to film. And then suddenly I wrote that poem, The White Dress, which people take to be a shroud, a wedding dress, whatever. And it is, I suppose. But I was also thinking about the way that in noir film, for instance, there's a white dress that's in any number of different films. And the white dress is the character. The actress comes and goes, changes, is this actress, that actress. But you know that that dress has a certain iconography, a certain character, a certain meaning that is pretty stable from film to film. And I found that tremendously interesting. I found the recycling of images, the steadiness of the symbology that goes through noir film and noir novels really appealing. And maybe it was a way of keeping a certain control over, I don't know, my subject matter. But I found that very appealing. The fact is that noir happens in black and white. And even as a sort of beginning writer, I think I was just intensely aware of this kind of odd parallel. I was writing in black and white. Noir film happened in black and white. It's crude, but it nevertheless kind of haunted what I was doing. You have two colors, black, white. It's either white or it's dark or, you know, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I found a kind of interesting parallel with issues of the book, the page, all of that.
You mentioned the white dress, the kind of ongoing iconography. Is that something that you attempt to do when you're putting together a book, try to keep a recurrent image that maybe doesn't have a particular meaning or a predefined meaning?
I don't know if I try to do it, but I certainly don't prevent myself from doing it. I remember Ted Hughes writing someplace about Sylvia Plath's work. He said something like, she never lets anything go to waste. Whatever scraps are lying around, she will make them into a poem. And I think, in an odd way, I feel like, well, that's a perfectly good image. And if I hadn't used it in this other poem, it would fit very well here. And so I'll put it here. So that whatever rule that I think a lot of poets, and for good reason, have developed about not repeating certain kinds of images or, you know, looking at things originally from poem to poem, that rule skipped me. So that I feel it's perfectly okay with me to reuse something. So I don't know that I set out to do it, but I don't prevent myself from doing it. I noticed that one of your questions has to do with art. I think that probably part of what supported me in my feeling that I could do this was watching painters work, who will canvas after canvas use the same kinds of images, create sequences of images, you know, same image, same tree at seven different lights, you know. And so whether I consciously thought of it or not, there were other kinds of models of making that influenced my doing that, my repeating of things.
Do you have conscious models of making from art that you take on?
I think actually not. Other people like, Anne Lauterbach, who worked in the visual arts for a long time, or Susan Howe, I think their consciousness of working with models of the visual arts, graphic arts, is much clearer and stronger than mine. I don't think I have a more fully thought out or formulated or complex way of thinking of the visual arts in my own work, other than what I've said.
Mm-hmm. I ask because you frequently make analogies to painting in particular. I wonder if you recognize the influence retroactively.
I think the subject matter is there. I think Anne Lauterbach's work, and I think Susan Howe's work, the poems themselves are put together in ways that were influenced by their experiences with the visual arts. I don't think that's true of my work. I think the subject matter is present, but I'm not sure that the way of composing, I don't know that there's any overflow into the way I compose or think about the object of the poem.
And then suddenly you make some of your poetic or aesthetic influences very clear, even stealing their voices and taking them on for yourself. I was wondering whether you could talk about the different ways that influence come to you by maybe talking about Gertrude Stein's influence on your thinking or your poetry as compared to Italo Calvino's influence on your writing.
To me, Gertrude Stein and Calvino, they're really the same writer. I think what I found so empowering and sort of flabbergasting when I came upon them, what I adore about Stein, well, first of all, I think she was an utter genius and utterly ahead of her time, as were a number of people in her generation. But it's fascinating to me how much, for instance, critical theory, she, in a sense, she was talking in a way that now the semiotics and other kinds of ways of presiding over literature in terms of critical theory are doing now. And I think the way that she, for instance, will linger upon and define and make into an object and an architecture the issue of the subordinate clause or the issue of the period or the semicolon, I felt that incredibly freeing. She made the invisible visible. You know, these were the materials that I was working with daily as a matter of course, and yet doing so in a way that, you know, they were just kind of beasts of burden carrying the meaning of the poem around with them. I adored that. You know, language poets talk about abrading the transparency of language. And I found her way of doing that very exciting and productive and annoying. You know, and then when I started reading Calvino, and I really started with If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. After a while, I simply had to prevent myself from reading that book because I thought, well, I don't need to write a book. Any book I've ever wanted to write, it's here. It exists in this book. But I think, again, the way he takes the relationship of the reader and writer and almost, you almost look at it sculpturally, almost sort of like in the book, chapter by chapter, it kind of turns you around that central figure of the reader and writer kind of locked together. And I found that, again, very influencing and very nourishing. And also, to talk about influences, I'm always interested in, like, the very local context. Around the time that I was working on The Dig and then suddenly, say, Vikram Seth's novel, Golden Gate, had come out. And there was an enormous amount of attention being given to the novelistic book of poems or the narrative book of poems. And I found myself extremely uninterested in these books. And I was upset that I was, because I understood why people were. I understood that the scope of them, the way they admitted into poetry certain things that had not been admitted. But, you know, I realized, frankly, that the reason I wasn't so interested in these books of poems was because I wasn't interested in the novelistic tradition that they were written in, which was, you know, sort of straight psychological realism, characters getting up in the morning, doing things, having conflicts, and all of that. I was much more interested in the tradition of Calvino. And if I wanted to write a book of poems that was in some way an interconnected set of short stories or novelistic in some way, I wanted to do it in the aesthetic of Calvino rather than in the aesthetic of Cheever, Updike.
Friends of mine and I have talked about the politics of narrative and the many ironies at work in there. The speaker of the poem is lambasting prose in a prose style.
Right.
Or in prose writing. But I've always found it most ironic that you are taking a lot of the narrative techniques and a lot of the metafiction novelist techniques into Then Suddenly, and then claiming that prose is something that is not of interest to this narrator.
Right. I think that what I did was say, oh, well, poetry is more aligned with this sort of novelistic school or technique. Prose is of the other. Whether that's accurate or not didn't much interest me. I just asserted that it was true, that Calvino was more of a poet than John Updike, or that his way of working was more poetic